I'm going to be talking about philosophy of value today. As you know, the topic is the for its own sake argument, but I'm going to start with the argument that's more commonly put in this place, which is the argument for intrinsic value. If the phrase intrinsic value is, as the philosopher Shelley Kagan puts it, something of a philosophical term of art, not in much use in ordinary conversation, it's nevertheless pretty familiar to literary critics, and it's frequently resorted to by advocates for the humanities. So if you look, for example, through the Arts Council literature, the AHRC, the ESRC, so forth, it's very frequently, sometimes tokenistically, the thing that's imported to show that your motives are in the right place, if you like, as a funding body, that despite all the other things you're claiming, you do understand that this is the base point, that you have to believe in the thing itself, its value. The attractions of the term intrinsic value are pretty clear, but its meaning is, on any close inspection, a bit less so. When it's employed in the defense of poetry and the defense of the humanities, it tends to denote one or both of two things. Negatively, resistance to requirements for demonstrated usefulness or instrumental value. Positively, a way of speaking about value that refers us back to the object, the thing itself, and offers to free us from the charge of mere subjectivism. Both those usages are problematic. Neither of them is commonplace in philosophy, it's worth adding. But before I detail the difficulties, I'm going to pause a little longer over the question of what hopes may be entailed in intrinsic value's persistence in the vocabulary, despite some pretty well-known reservations about its validity. The major hope invested in the idea of intrinsic value is, I take it, that we might, by invoking it, be enabled to stop the hard and unsatisfactory work of trying to justify the value of the humanities and the value of studying them. Large claims of external use or purpose, economic, philosophical, political, would then disappear, or they'd retreat into second place, and the value would become wrapped up in the object and the activity, which could be deemed self-justifying. So remember, the very first sentence that I started with is that ideally, the humanities would justify themselves just by our doing them. There is, after all, a problem with the defense of higher education in the humanities that, however pluralistic it is, relies upon their effects on us individually, on the culture, on political life. If advocacy for the humanities can say nothing about their content, the things they study or curate, the practices they cultivate, the knowledge they own, the interpretations they make and continually remake, then it's in danger of asserting consequential importance at the expense of any account of the humanities as good in themselves. Let me put that more simply. If you rely upon a defense that talks about the things that you affect in the world or on human beings, you're in danger of giving away a hostage, because there will be other things that can probably achieve that effect more directly or more economically, in the broader sense of the word economically. Jeremy Bentham's much disparaged view that I quoted in an earlier lecture, the game of pushpin is of equal value with the arts and sciences of music and poetry, is one logical result of what can happen if you take your eye off content. The value of the state of mind enabled, so that's pleasure for Bentham, is upheld, but you give up on any discriminations of worth at the level of what you're actually doing, labouring over, enjoying, and so forth. This outcome will trouble some humanities scholars, I think, much more than others. Depends on the importance you attach to judgment as a further step beyond interpretation. But I don't need to raise so early on in the argument the spectre of renewed dispute about the canon and the conditions for judgment. We can observe more simply that the technical skills associated with disciplines and groups of disciplines have evolved in relation to particular kinds of material. Hence Richard Rorty's provocatively banal defense of philosophy as an autonomous discipline. He says, someone's got to read those difficult books and it takes a lot of time. Nice. By the same token, someone's got to study the literature, the art, the films, the music, the historical archive, and so on. Okay, so that's your job. You have to study the novels, the poems, the plays, whatever it is. Understandable though the impulse to secure intrinsic value is, the endeavour comes beset though, as I said, with some pretty serious philosophical complications. No substantial contribution to the literature on the subject fails to foreground them, to the extent where the difficulty of reconciling the desire for intrinsic value to be true with the recognition of its entanglement and fallacy can be said to be part of the point. As the poet and critic Geoffrey Hill, who some of you were hearing yesterday, remarks with regret of Ruskin's attempts to defend intrinsic value as the self-contained power or worth of a thing. He says, intrinsic value, so understood, is at best a promissory note, at worst a semantic relic to ward off the evil eye of commodity. To put things in that way is to draw attention to a particular area of difficulty, that of purifying judgments of value from considerations of ulterior value, which would mean, at worst, considerations of exchange value in the unstable marketplace of language and ideas. Now, others than Hill are going to be more concerned with purifying judgment, perhaps from political or theological concerns, or from the eccentricities of individual subjectivity. but I think he aptly gauges the general character of the aspiration towards a self-contained, self-evident good. Shelley Kagan's not alone among contemporary philosophers in thinking that much of the theory traditionally implied by the term intrinsic value has by now exhausted its claim to philosophical respect. The specific claim that intrinsic value is based on intrinsic properties may well, he says, be false, and there's some danger that we will make a fetish out of philosophical beliefs in it. Kagan defends the view that value as an end, which he takes to be one conventional interpretation of intrinsic value, need not depend solely upon an object's intrinsic properties. In some cases, he says, we can explain something having intrinsic value by noting the various properties that provide the basis of its intrinsic value. Some of these properties may be relational, and some of these may have instrumental value. Abraham Lincoln's pen, that's his example, Kagan's example, has instrumental value as an implement for writing. Other pens would have served as well for signing the Emancipation Proclamation. But the fact that this was the pen Lincoln used gives it, on that basis, intrinsic value. And if that's right, the traditional philosophical contrast between intrinsic value and instrumental value is an error. In some cases, instrumental value may ground intrinsic value. In pursuing the distinction between intrinsic value and value as an end, or valuing a thing for its own sake, Kagan is working an increasingly well-worn furrow in value theory. The extent of the doubts expressed in relation to the intrinsic differs, but the broad conclusion that we can substantially modify or even dispense with intrinsic value without having to give up on objective value commands fairly wide agreement. The proper contrast with intrinsic value, as Christine Korsgaard points out in one of the most influential contributions to the current debate in philosophy, is not instrumental value but extrinsic value, the value a thing gets from another source. The right contrast for instrumental value, on the other hand, is a thing that's valued for its own sake or end. She considers intrinsic value a viable concept, but the means by which she rescues it may not attract general agreement, given that it depends upon a Kantian metaphysical protection against infinite regress in the conditions for goodness. So one thing only, the goodwill, is intrinsically good. Human beings possess this intrinsic value by virtue of their capacity for valuing things rationally. They identify good things by means of making rational choices about what to value, so things are good because we desire or choose them, or take an interest in them, rather than our desiring them because they are good. The attraction of this theory is that it allows us to define objective value as something conferred by human beings under the conditions in which we live, psychological, economic, historical, symbolic, and so forth. The drawbacks, as you might expect from a Kantian view, and I'm summarizing a number of philosophers who've been in argument with Korsgaard over this, they include perhaps too great an emphasis on coherence of reasoning as the basis of our relation with the things we care about. Relatedly, too strong an assumption about the capacity of universal laws to confer human identity, and relatedly, again, too buoyant an expectation of grounding ethical life in something like psychic health or a state of flourishing. Now, I'm, as I said, selecting from a very large contemporary literature on intrinsic value. It would be misleading to suggest that it has suffered a final philosophical defeat, or on the other hand, that reservations about it are of recent appearance. If the term now seems to many who employ it a failed enterprise, necessarily girded around with caution, irony, self-consciousness, then this is nothing new, the primary difference being the degree of cumulative erosion and conviction. Have a look at the OED's first recorded usages for intrinsic value. They're presented within the third definition for intrinsic in the adjectival form, intrinsic, adjective 3a, belonging to the thing in itself or by its very nature inherent, essential, proper, of its own. 1642, J. Howell, if one would go to the intrinsic value of things. 1661 to 98, R. South, as if every such single act could by its own intrinsic worth merit a glorious eternity. 1691, Locke, the intrinsic value of silver considered as money is that estimate which common consent has placed on it. All three citations approach the term intrinsic as a conditional effect, a hypothetical, a provisional result of consensus, not fact. Howell, perhaps the least obviously complicating at first glance, is in fact writing of the advantages to France of remaining insular from Spain in its political and trading arrangements, of keeping most of its trade intrinsic, though the whole can't be. So intrinsic value speaks from the start, or as far back as our major dictionary has yet recorded, of an impossible and probably undesirable isolationism and valuation. Ruskin, as it happens, is not among the subsequent citations of supporting evidence offered by the OED, but his name's been crucial to recent attempts to make good intrinsic value for the English language. If he deserves special notice even now, in spite of the historical inaccuracy of his employment of the term, And with all his paternalistic benevolence towards the added value of labour, it is, Geoffrey Hill suggests, because his social writings lent the term an aura that was distinctively forward-looking where others had preferred elegy or a fantasy of restoration. Ruskin holds out a positive definition of intrinsic value as contained possibility or promise, that form of value bound up in things that support life, a power or worth that, used or unused, escapes reduction to the effects of supply and demand. So I'm quoting Ruskin. Intrinsic value is the absolute power of anything to support life. A sheaf of wheat of given quality and weight has in it a measurable power of sustaining the substance of the body. A cubic foot of pure air, a fixed power of sustaining its warmth. And a cluster of flowers of given beauty, a fixed power of enlivening or animating the senses and heart. It does not in the least affect the intrinsic value of the wheat, the air, or the flowers that men refuse or despise them, used or not. Their own power is in them, and that particular power is in nothing else. The Beatitudes, consider the lilies of the field, are here blending into anti-utilitarian pastoralism. The supporting of life is understood by Ruskin generously, not as a mere sustenance of the body, though sustaining physical life of course matters, but as a vital sustenance also of the heart and mind through given beauty and the power of sensory animation. No one has pressed the allure and vulnerability of that aura harder than Hill, who must indeed stand as the prime exponent of a modern intention to keep faith with the commitment of just dealing with ideas and words expressed by the term intrinsic value, despite full knowledge of philosophical objections to the term's lack of clarity. Now, there are plenty of people who object at this point that Hill is scarcely a representative figure in contemporary debate about value, though one might counter who is a representative figure now. But the very distance at which he's working from most others in the strenuously theological cast of his writing gives the more significance to those aspects of his thinking that chime with more general concerns about the tenability or otherwise of claims for the intrinsic value of the things the humanities study. Now, I've selected him over the most obvious alternative that some of you I know will care about very much, and that's John Dewey arguing against intrinsic value and in favour of contextual valuation. I've done that for forensic reasons, really, partly because we're working in an English context here, and partly because the pessimistic cast of Hill's thinking, by contrast with the optimism of Dewey, allows me to press a harder scepticism before trying to rescue a for its own sake argument. And partly because Hill's poetry lets me take the theoretical discussion of value straight into the practical work of critical valuation. This is Hill in the essay called Translating Value. So all the Hill references here, apart from the poetry I'll be dealing with in a minute, come from his collected writings, his collected critical writings. I do not myself see that a longing for something indispensable is per se misguided, though I can see the dangers and would accept that most attempts to embody the longing create metaphysical wraiths. Ruskin's intrinsic value is, in and of itself, such a wraith, but according to my argument, it remains a term which points in the right direction, towards semantic realizations that have some substance. For Hill, substantive realizations of value are less objects of desire than cause for continual ethical striving. His endeavours to refine the term over the years would be critically incomprehensible without recognition of their foundation in his Christianity. Hill believes in original sin and understands our efforts to secure meaning and value through language as inseparable from that terrible Aboriginal calamity. I would seriously propose a theology of language, he writes, it's a much quoted line, in Language, Suffering and Silence, 1999, This would comprise a critical examination of the grounds for claiming A, that the shock of semantic recognition must be also a shock of ethical recognition, and that this is the action of grace in one of its minor but far from trivial types. B, that the art and literature of the late 20th century require a memorializing, a memorizing of the dead. The primary realization of value that emerges from this theology of language takes the form of ethical work. That means the poetic and critical endeavor to gauge value through the accurate weighing of words, not least the weighing of their inevitable imprecisions and ambiguities. We are, in a metaphor sounded in depth within his poetic sequence, scenes from Comus, accountants who cannot make ourselves or our words add up, but who will ultimately be held to account for our speech. The changing ways in which Hill's poetry and criticism have assayed intrinsic value in language in the hope of pointing us in the right direction are a substantial matter for study in their own right. Hill wants our endeavours in the language, especially poetic and critical language, to have intrinsic value insofar as they can withstand the corrosions, debasements, falsifications of the world of commerce and our own fallen condition. Language is the medium in which that condition expresses itself, but in which still we may hope to find succour, even grace. a problem even for admirers of Hill, and they include many who don't share his cultural conservatism or his theology, is that it is sometimes followed that he has wanted to supplement and secure our efforts at virtuous action with a claim to the intrinsic value of the achieved poem, its value then standing in some elusive sense independent of our engagement with it. My purpose here being a reckoning not only with the defense of poetry, but with justifications for the humanities, I'm just going to use one iteration of that endeavor, probably the best known. Given the concern of these lectures with how we value the content of the humanities, as I said, there seems to be evident merit in putting a work of the humanities on the page. So have a look at this. You have on the sheet from The Triumph of Love, 1998. Active virtue, that which shall contain its own passion in the public weal. Do you follow? Or can you at least take the drift of the thing? The struggle for a noble vernacular. This did not end with Petrarch, but where is it? Where has it got us? Does it stop in our case with Dryden? Or perhaps Milton's political sonnets? The cherished stock hacked into ransom and ruin. The voices of distinction far back indistinct. Still, I'm convinced that shaping, voicing are types of civic action. Or, slightly to refashion this, that Wordsworth's two prefaces stand with his great tract on the Convention of Cintra, witnessing to the Praesidium in the sacred name of things betrayed. Intrinsic value I am somewhat less sure of. It seems implicate with active virtue, but I cannot say how precisely. Partaking of both fact and recognition, it must be, therefore, in effect at once agent and predicate, imponderables brought home to the brute mass and detail of the world, there by some to be pondered. The active virtue involved in the poet's struggle for a noble vernacular, Hill takes in starting to be definite, definable, having achieved form in the cherished historical stock or root of our poetry, such poetry as has contained passion in the public weal, Petrarch, Dryden, Milton, Wordsworth. Active virtue requires the drawing of one's own private eccentricities of powerful emotion and interest into the public weal or wealth, the word public deliberately preferred to the false promise of common. But the desired definition comes under quick suspicion of indefinition in the following lines and in the analysis of our contemporary civic realm that they hold out for our contemplation. So the quasi-lexicographic opening statement isn't strictly a definition, rather the declaration of a future-directed ideal, or perhaps a pronouncement that mimics a performative utterance, that disputed power of poetry. The desired definition drifts mimetically but also confessedly towards indistinction. Active virtue, distinct grammatical subject, becomes the thing, this, it. Against this tendency to lose our hold on active virtue, Hill will assert still, even now, even so, allaying doubts, that the activities of shaping and saying are types, models, emblems, prefigurings of virtuous civic action, but can he claim for them intrinsic value? The pondering of the intrinsic through these lines works in reverse to that of active virtue. It starts in indistinction, announcing an object he would fain be certain of, and gradually accrues definition, or rather weight might be the better word, since the lines are beset by evidence of a grammatical and lexical struggle for this to be an act of definition and not just a talking into being or instantiation. The overall structural effect then is not quite chiasmus, but something close to it. One thing's going from definition to indefinition, the other from indefinition to definition. This is an idea of intrinsic value that Hill wants us to know he knows is in trouble, though he's prepared to press on. When something's given away with respect to it, I cannot say how, it's quickly reclaimed precisely, not the saying but the precision in question. If the language protests too much, it must be, it concedes its own weakness, therefore in effect, though without conceding the point. In effect dissolves certainty but also directs us towards effects, achieved works where intrinsic value may be found. Hill's reliance on grammar here as both underpinning techne and a source of analogy invites us to think about grammar itself as at once part of the mechanism of the weighing and an element in what's being weighed. It structures the pondered relation between intrinsic value and attributed value, the thing itself and the qualities attached to it, but it also threatens to unmoor it, to discover the agent as properly a predicate, or to put it another way, as just an aura affected by our attribution of qualities. One could observe something similar about Hill's use of the troche in ways that moor and unmoor, declare weight and take it away, but I'll move on. Brute mass is presumably Hill going back to C.S. Pierce's statement that actuality is something brute, there is no reason in it. I confess I'm not won by these final lines, and not only because the notion of bringing imponderables home to where there is no reason sounds for the context too like throwing in the towel altogether. The deixis, the there, offers a grammatical bringing home of the subject that nicely ambiguates. It's there, it's achieved, it's intrinsic value upheld, but it's also over there, it's out of reach. The "by some," however, gives trouble, since it cannot but sound as "by me," Geoffrey Hill, picking up on "I am somewhat." Hill wants, I think, the F.A.H. Bradley-esque pitch of "some," which he's called not a planned evasion or cop-out, but an act of apprehension that cannot make it as far as articulation. What would be apprehended in this case being the problem of value, as much as value itself. He also presumably wants the sonorousness of "some ponder," but for me, the awareness of Hill putting a finger on the scales, nudging intrinsic value just that fraction towards apprehension, disturbs the pitch. Although I'm sure he would be genial and tough. The intrusion of the first person explicitly on my own part, as I detect implicitly on Hill's, is deliberate. It's not a disparagement of Hill, who knows this too, to say that the sorting out of good readers from bad, attentive weighers of semantics from the inattentive, admits the kind of contingency in judgment, despite all efforts to rise above contingency, that so bothered Hume. There are, after all, elements in judgment that cannot be realized as if they were facts, cannot be apprehended or touched with the finger on the place, as Hill in 1999 would have it. In part, this is because, as Peter Robinson puts it after Bradley, no one, not even Hill, has read enough to command the data. In part, it's because there are legitimate differences in judgments that we may reach on the basis of some evidence. Hume attempted to get around the problem of how then one establishes public agreements about what is and isn't worthy evaluation through the pliability of the term taste. Taste is an old-fashioned and largely discredited term for the subjective response to art, and the term humanities won't work for me here, although the point about subjectivity and aesthetic valuation is germane to the question of subjectivity and valuation generally, including as it bears on the aesthetic and non-aesthetic aspects of the humanities. Taste smacks unappealingly now of Saintsbury comparing criticism with wine tasting, but it's not obvious what other term in the critical lexicons of today is doing the work this word or its near companion sensibility once did, work that cultural criticism has largely abandoned, though philosophy of value, of course, hasn't. Hill's an exception, weighing the word taste closely in his reading of Hume and Hobbes as he considers the pressure of collective opinion upon individual judgment. Contaminated though taste and sensibility were from the start by social caste, Hume used both terms to open up the response to the aesthetic as a field of experience and judgment, with its basis in the sense impressions of the individual mind and body, a move which then required convincing arguments to close the gap between the phantasm of individual sensation and the common social ownership of standards of taste. It's a weakness of Hume's account of subjectivism, David Wiggins points out, that it rests so heavily on an analogy between aesthetic taste and ordinary sensory, gustatory, etc. taste, an analogy which doesn't help us much with the epistemological difficulty of relating one's individual response to any true and decisive standard in aesthetics or in morals. It's the strength of the metaphor, he observes, that it prompts Hume to think about the condition of the judge. Strong sense united to delicate sentiment, in Hume's words, improved by practice, perfected by comparison, cleared of all prejudice, and to posit these qualities as substantial and demonstrable and possessed by large numbers of people. But this produces a paradox, or something close to a paradox. In order to deal with what is internal to the individual, a phantasm of the feelings, Hume has to produce a non-subjective foundation in an independent standard of taste supported by a nearly homogeneous human nature. To that degree, Hume might seem to anticipate the tendency now to treat individual responses as immediately generalizable. So you must have noticed, for example, the prominence in recent years of theories of emotion or of cognition that offer to tell us about subjectivity and its social conditioning, but they're actually really not talking at the level of the subject. They're talking about generalizable, even universal theories of what a subject is, what cognition is, what emotion is. But there seems to me an important difference in that the language of taste at least retains an acknowledgement of a double epistemological difficulty, the difficulty of connecting the qualities of the object to the response of the subject, and the difficulty in turn of connecting that individual subjective response to a true standard. As Hill put it, the significance of Hume on taste is that he sees it partly as wrought, a matter of prejudicates, and in part arrived at through a mental discipline, a self-knowledgeable understanding of how deeply prejudiced we are, even or especially in our common agreements. Where I have to part company from Hill is at the implication that submitting ourselves to mental discipline and understanding our own prejudices is enough by way of response to the non-intrinsic qualities that impinge upon what we would want to call intrinsic value. Hill's efforts to redeem not intrinsic value, but the notion of just dealing with the standard of value which intrinsic value precariously enshrines, are, as far as I'm aware, the furthest any contemporary writer has pressed intrinsic value as a philosophical term of art. That they are arduous efforts probably goes without saying. some of that arduousness is unavoidable. We might well think it would be better for us to be able to make arguments for intrinsic value that aren't dependent on metaphysical wraiths like course guards and Kant's intrinsically goodwill, or a belief in final and basic value derived from belief in God. But as John Stuart Mill put it, questions of ultimate ends are not amenable to direct proof. As he immediately went on to say, this doesn't mean that they are unamenable to considerations that will determine the intellect either to give or withhold its assent. That's in utilitarianism. There's no possibility of a non-metaphysical defense for the intrinsic value of the humanities. There is, however, ample room for a considered account of why the humanities are worth, I think, valuing for their own sake. How far does that move from the more towards the more relaxed, less philosophically fetishizable, because less ostensibly technical idiom of for its own sake really help us? At least one late 20th century philosopher reflecting on the term for its own sake has found it paradoxical. Like other reflexive-related constructions, T.S. Champlin claims, especially those generated by the prefix self, self-evidence, self-generation, self-explanatoriness, for its own sake looks a bit like a philosophical cheat. In this instance, the problem lies with appearing to present something as the means to its own end, so doing A for the sake of doing A. Does the term sake have any purchase here? It's an attractive feature for its own sake that sake, though not a technical term, has a degree of opacity about it taken in isolation. It's not readily paraphrasable. What word would you put in place of sake if you were trying to give a paraphrase? So that though we generally think we know what the phrase means, the main term on which it leans requires some elucidation by way of the dictionary. As an independent substantive, sake is, OED tells us, obsolete, meaning in Old English contention, strife, dispute, a contention at law, a suit, cause, action, also a charge or accusation of guilt, a ground of accusation, hence often indicative in Old English of guilt, sin, fault, offence, crime. It survives now only in phrases, for the sake of, for one's or a thing's sake. In these phrasal forms, sake is given the following glosses: out of consideration for, on account of one's interest in or regard for a person, on a person's account, or without special relation to persons, out of regard or consideration for a thing, on account of, because of, something regarded in the light of an end, aim, purpose, etc. Often equals out of desire for, in order to attain, etc. If for the sake of is to mean on account of one's interest in or one's consideration or desire for something, then for its own sake does indeed present a puzzling self-reflexivity, on account of its own interest in or consideration for or desire for itself. The old association with guilt complicates further, since it offers to ghost the phrase with a more conflictual self-reflexivity on account of its being in contention with itself. In either reading, sake threatens to double the act of accounting on account of its being on its own account. But reading sake off as a compacted phrase within a phrase rather misses the point, since one of the distinguishing features of the historically entrenched phrase, generally speaking, is that it can conjure not so much a unified notion as a portable effect of style. A phrase is a group of words, I was taught with understandable concern to simplify by my primary school teachers in New Zealand. Later grammatical lessons admitted a degree of complication, which either doesn't have a noun attached or a predicate or doesn't have a finite verb, compare clause. But a phrase is also a turn of phrase, a degree less exacting than a philosophical term of art, a common or idiomatic expression, a striking or pithy expression. Champlin's path through the philosophical problems the semantic inexactness presents takes in some ways a similar route to Course Guards. His paper was written with other aims in view, but the coincidence of method here seems to me testimony to the extent to which Kant has attached his name to the idea of doing good for its own sake. But where Course Guard holds on to the Kantian metaphysical condition, the protection of the goodwill as the one stronghold of intrinsic value, Champlin is even less happy to accept the exclusion of ulterior considerations from the definition of genuine worth. Consider the desert island discs scenario. I've updated it from the 1987 form it had in Champlin. You are cast away with Kirsty Young on a desert island and asked to choose 8 pieces of music to take with you. Did you choose this piece of music for reasons of nostalgia or for its own sake? Asks Kirsty. I chose this piece not as a peg on which to hang a memory, but because I find it very beautiful. Listening to it gives me great pleasure, is your reply. Kirsty, turned Kantian inquisitor, pounces. You claim, she says, to have chosen the music for its own sake, yet you also admit that you chose the music for the sake of its beauty and for the pleasure it gives you. But this is surely quite mad, Champlin objects, presumably on the grounds that beauty is here a good-making property of something good in itself. It isn't, of course, mad if one is pursuing a metaphysical security for final value, But it does look a bit that way if it's taken to express naive dismay, not just at the impurity of the notion of the good, but at the impurity of human motives for affirming value. The rule of action, as Mill put it, is one thing, the actual motive felt or espoused quite another. Or to put it another way, one has to distinguish metaphysics from psychology in matters of valuation. And for its own sake may have an advantage in clarity over intrinsic value here, insofar as it keeps the psychological component in valuation more clearly in view. The consequences of frankly admitting the psychological impurity of our motives for valuing things are liberating. Champlin puts it nicely in concluding that the temptation towards value isolationism held up by the phrase for its own sake is something we can and should guard against. When Wilde and other late 19th century aesthetes adopted the phrase art for art's sake, they were not divorcing art from life, he writes. They were insisting that the artist is not in the service of religion, conventional morality, party politics, diplomacy, patriotism, the state, or any of the other forces which try to reduce art to a means to their ends and to rob art of the status of an end in itself. For my purposes, the important part of this description is the opening clarification that for its own sake declares freestanding valuation while not isolating the thing valued from life. Once one allows that the rule, valuation of the thing as an end, admits of many different means, desire, interest, pleasure, memory, anxiety, by which an individual comes to observe the rule in the non-dogmatic sense of observe, then the problem of falsely isolating the thing valued from its context disappears. One has then the possibility of our concurring, or indeed not concurring, with the value of a thing for its own sake, without the valuation being discredited by the variety or even the incoherence of the routes by which we got to it. Okay, now to say this much doesn't of course answer the question of how agreements about value are reached in the first place or what degree of consensus is requisite to support continuing acceptance of them as, inter alia, worthwhile objects of study. There will be much argument ultimately about value, Frank Kermode predicted in 1997 amidst agitated debate about falling numbers of students taking humanities courses in the US. The apparent exceptionality of English courses was thought then to be explained by the large number of women students still excluded from entry-level science. In the end, we have to fall back on one thing, Kermode thought, intuitions of value, without which the task is nearly hopeless. But we can also put considerable weight, and I add to Kermode here, on long-standing cultural assumptions and evolving local settlements about what in our culture has more and less durable worth for us, and not always the same thing, what will reward study. These might themselves be seen as intuitions if intuitions are taken to be non-inferential, foundational beliefs. Now, I'm going to skip over, you'll be relieved to say, the quarrelsome terrain that has been the question of the canon in literature departments for many decades now and that still intermittently provokes headlines in the press. There is, however, I want to note, an especially unlovely genre that is the love letter to literature and to the humanities more widely, presented by a professor of literature in the form of hate mail to the profession. It's a standard observation of that genre, shared by many who don't endorse the pessimism or the anti-professionalism, that literary studies is the representative discipline of the humanities, the discipline in relation to which the wider public formulates ideas about the value of the humanities as a whole, what its true value is, whether the university today does or does not properly recognise that value. There's not an absolute truth, I think, as a description. There are elements in history, especially in the teaching of history, that also provoke very wide public attachments. But I think it is remarkably true that literature has tended to stand as the example of what is being properly or improperly taught, what canons are acceptable and what canons have become absurd or, you know, offensive to a wider public. Insofar as the claim has any justice at all, and it seems to me have very little, it's typically made by professors of English and not by those who might want to challenge their priority, say the professors of history or philosophy. There are evident reasons why it might be thought so. It might be thought the case that English has a kind of priority. As Stanley Fish has repeatedly remarked, the fact that many people read and care about literature with other interests and pleasures in view than those that belong to its formal study means that they can be inclined to view academic statements about literature, whether theoretical or historical or just technical, as obscurantist or worse, as a defamation of the real value of the subject. The sense of a cultural propriety in the object of study tends to be especially strong when it's attached to a romantic Arnoldian belief in the study of literature as the study of life itself. Such protectionism of literature outside the academy, Fish observes, is often coupled with a tendency to deplore those aspects of the academy which smack of the marketplace, matters of publishing, tenure, and professional power. To the problem of how the wider public perceives the contributions of literary criticism to the general good must be added the peculiar incoherence that has long infected public understanding of the function of criticism. As Bruce Robbins remarks, the near paradoxical standing of literary criticism among the other disciplines as the staging ground for social critique when literature itself was losing its social influence rests on its inheritance of a notion of culture as critical, traced by Raymond Williams from Romanticism through Arnold Pater and their successors. Where criticism is set against social activity by its very definition. Declinism has been one rhetorically powerful expression of this incoherence within the valuation of criticism as manifested at the interface between the academy and the wider public sphere. There's been a tendency, especially pronounced in the States, where the professionalization of the subject was earlier codified and where the virtues of professionalization, as I said in the second lecture, are historically more closely related to democratization, to bemoan the supposed sequestration of the university from the public realm, even as the humanities departments enact their given role of providing critical distance. Hence the professionals' sometime revulsion against what could only then appear hyper-professionalization. Hence also the sometime wish to pull up an imaginary drawbridge between the academy, the ivory tower, and the world. If this description looks less perfectly fitted to the UK in the early 21st century than it was to the US in the late 20th century, that may be in part because of continuing differences in the extent and cultural value of professionalism in the States, and not just the UK, but many other countries in which the value of the humanities is being publicly debated at present. America is, in that sense, I think, a special case, and patterns of discussion, as I've kept saying, originating there are potentially misleading when applied elsewhere. The sense of some historical distance on the anti-professionalist rhetoric that was common in the 1990s may also be evidence that well-placed criticism at the time had effect, and that asserting the value of the humanities at the expense of the humanities profession, using English as a type, is less often the unthought-through reflex or own goal that it has often been. Other disciplines, after all, have their versions of conflict between the priorities of the academy and those of the general public. History, for example, can find itself in similar difficulties when it deals with topics within living memory, or when it addresses subjects on which there are strong inherited beliefs, say the rightness or wrongness of the historical prosecution of particular national or ethnic interests. But it's at least clearer what the sources of historical knowledge are, and in that sense, history has sometimes claimed an advantage over literature when in the position of representing the humanities. Knowledge, as many have pointed out before me, is more of a component in what literature departments teach than we have sometimes been willing to say, a point true also for philosophy, languages, the arts. If, as that second lecturer explored, interpretation, judgment, and the performance of the scholar's own style are often deemed to be of more importance, these activities nevertheless supervene on and would be impossible without underlying disciplinary knowledge. Newman famously thought that it was, in the final analysis, the apprehension of the value of knowledge for its own sake that linked all the faculties of the liberal university. I am asked, this is on your sheet, I am asked what is the end of university education and of the liberal or philosophical knowledge which I conceive it to impart. I answer that what I have already said has been sufficient to show that it has a very tangible, real, and sufficient end, though the end cannot be divided from that knowledge itself. Knowledge is capable of being its own end. Such is the constitution of the human mind that any kind of knowledge, if it be really such, is its own reward. Now, when I say that knowledge is not merely a means to something beyond it, or a preliminary of certain arts into which it naturally resolves, but an end sufficient to rest in and to pursue for its own sake, surely I'm uttering no paradox, for I am stating what is both intelligible in itself and has ever been the common judgment of philosophers and the ordinary feeling of mankind. Newman strategically underestimated the extent of agreement between philosophers then as now. He may have been right about the ordinary feeling of mankind, but that's rather less open to demonstration. If one exerts the core claim, knowledge is its own end, he would certainly seem in danger of the kind of isolation of knowledge from its context that has bedeviled some versions of the claim to intrinsic value. Stated without qualification, the claim would go too far, but it's hedged about by Newman with a high degree of caution that isn't often remarked upon. Knowledge is capable of being its own end, though the real and sufficient end to which it contributes is not made up of knowledge alone, which is rather a contributing factor. Insofar as it is an end in itself, it has that status because of the constitution of the human mind, which leads us to take not pleasure exactly, pleasure not being high in Newman's lexicon of approbation, but reward. These are then matters of psychology rather than logical exactness or even metaphysical security of definition, the fundamentally theological motive behind Newman's valuation of education notwithstanding. What we're offered in sum isn't a perfect security, but sufficient intelligibility in judgment for human purposes. One can and should dispute Newman's insistence on the valuation of knowledge as what finally unites us, but in the manner of his apprehension of that value, what he says has surprisingly durable validity. By way of a strong recasting of Newman for the present day, this is John Guillory in 2003, urging the humanities to be less quickly dismissive of their claim to knowledge. Knowledge should be defended for its own sake, not solely for its instrumental benefits, because it is the object of a human desire, the desire to know, a desire that ought not to be frustrated any more than any other human desire. I think there's a missing but there. Not solely for its instrumental benefits, but because it is the object of a human desire, the desire to know, a desire that ought not to be frustrated any more than any other human desire. The order, given what I said at the beginning on the basis of philosophy of value, needs reversing. Those who desire knowledge as good in itself will do so because they think it's good, not that it is good because they desire it. But desire has here the same rightly depurifying effect on the for its own sake claim that surety of reward had for Newman. It reminds us that value as an end is still value as apprehended by individual subjectivities within particular societies and cultures at particular historical junctures. If you admit, Pache Newman, alongside knowledge for its own sake, pleasure, work, interest, affect, all for their own sakes, you have, I think, a range of modes of engagement with the objects of study that have, like those objects themselves, a legitimate claim to value as an end.